And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your phone calls this hour with Matt Stein as we continue talking about when technology fails next on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Matt Stein, when technology fails, also when disaster strikes. And Matt, we were talking about the dirty bombs and talk again about just how deadly they can be for the immediate vicinity.
Well, the dirty bomb will not actually be directly deadly. The scare from that is that if you ingest some hot particles, then you'll get cancer somewhere down the road. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of a fear factor. In other words, outside of the actual explosion killing people, say it blows up a block, a city block or something, you know, outside of that, it's more of the disruption to businesses, because who wants to live and work in an area where there's radioactive stuff sitting around and it's not all been, you know, and they're going to have to go in with radiation suits and Geiger counters and radiation meters and find the spots and try to decontaminate it. So it's much more the fear factor and the disruption than actually killing you. But if you happen, and the fear is real, though, because if you happen to be that guy who sucked in a hot particle in his lungs and dies of lung cancer 5 years later, then it, you know, your life's over and you were out of luck. So what you'd want to do there is, if you know a dirty bomb's gone off, one is you know, try, if you've got a HEPA filter in your house, keep it running and stay near it, and it will suck and clean all the air. And then when the dirt, you know, like a day or two later, take that HEPA filter and get rid of, you know, be very careful. Use a suit that you throw away and pull the filter out and throw it out and bag it up and throw it out, because you don't want to, because it's going to be sucking all the particles in your room. So there's things you can do, like drinking filtered water, breathing filtered air, et cetera. And then once things have settled down, like the last thing you want to do is go running around outside right after the dirty bomb's gone off trying to get out of the area, because then the chances of you being contaminated with something is significant. So it's laying low until it's blown out and then getting out of the area with you and your family till it's had a long time to decontaminate. That's what you need to do. But chances of you actually dying from the dirty bomb are very slim. Whereas, you know, the nuclear meltdown's another case. Like Chernobyl happened, and in long term, you know, short term, very few people died from Chernobyl. A couple hundred people.
Long term.
But long term, epidemiological, I always have trouble with that word, studies indicate that a million people died long-term from illnesses related to Chernobyl.
Jeez.
And 3 million people suffered long-term illness. So 3 million people had things like Chernobyl AIDS, which is acquired immune from the radiation, the immune deficiency. They had thyroid tumors, they had various cancers.
Mm. And is it still ongoing?
It's still ongoing. And there's still huge areas. And one of the terrible things that happened after Chernobyl is that the government said, okay, rather than taking all of the downwind produce and eggs and dairy products and meat and just destroying it, what the government did is said, well, we're going to just spread it all over the country and give everybody a dose.
Oh.
And so instead of destroying that and quarantining,
which is what they should have done,
they spread it around. So people just, so you know, how do you sue them and say, I'm sick and dying of cancer 10 years later? How do you prove
you can't.
It came from Chernobyl?
You can't prove
that. And that's the problem with nuclear meltdowns, is you can't prove anything. But the epidemiological studies look at the statistics of the downwind areas versus other parts of the world where there was no Chernobyl and said, these cancers, these diseases, these upticks caused a million people to die early deaths and 3 million people to be sickened. And so that's the results from one Chernobyl. Now imagine that there was 10, 20, 30, 50 of those happening in the United States at the same time. That's a potential scenario from an EMP. Terrible scenario. Something that we need to protect against. And it's protectable to some extent. With the government could provide EMP hardened containers at each of our nuclear power plants. They could provide backup generating systems in each of those containers. They could provide backup fuel for a year's worth of fuel at each of the sites to keep the generators going. And they could provide protection to our huge transformers in the grid for about the price of a B-2 bomber, a single stealth bomber. We could prevent the end of the United States and really the end of the world as we know it in the event of an extreme solar event or an EMP terrorist attack. We couldn't prevent all the bad stuff from happening, but we could prevent the end of the world type stuff happening, or the end of the world as we know it. The world will continue on. Humans might not, and certainly it might be a horrible existence for those humans that do, but we could prevent it from being that bad for the price of, you know, $2 or $3 billion, which is a lot more money than you and I got. But as far as the government's concerned, you know, compared to like wars in Iraq or bailing out the banks on Wall Street when the economy collapsed, you know, that's chump change in my mind for a government to prevent the end of the world as we know it. And so far, they're talking about it, but not doing it.
Let's talk about the rule of threes.
Okay, the rule of threes, that gives you an idea of what's important when, you know, when a crisis has happened, there's injuries or whatever, what's most important to deal with. So the first three is three seconds without blood flow to the brain, and you pass out. You know, 3 minutes without oxygen. So basically that's saying like, hey, you got to keep the blood going. You got to keep the heart pumping. You got to keep that going. And if the heart's not pumping, you got to get that going real soon because things fail like really fast. 3 minutes without oxygen, and you pass out. Like, you know, you can't breathe. You have no access to oxygen. You got 3 minutes, and you pass out. 3 hours in extreme heat, extreme cold. Now, these are rough guidelines. Of course, you know, some cases it'll be 6 hours, some case two. But 3 hours without proper clothing or protection in extreme heat, you can start, like, ceasing to function, getting heat stroke, your brain's frying, or extreme cold, you start getting hypothermic. Now, of course, if you're 10 minutes in ice-cold water in the Arctic, you know, like when the Titanic went down, you know, you could be hypothermic in 10 minutes, not 3 hours. 3 days without water, and people start to have kidney failure if they're having to be active. Now, miners in a cave, underground, cool, they're not doing anything, they're just laying there. Yeah, 6, 7 days, 9 days, they might survive with no water. But most of us, if you got to be physically active, you have no water, 3 days without water, people can start failing. Now, Sonoran Desert could be 3 or 4 hours, but, you know, normal conditions, heat, work, 3 days. 3 months without food, 3 weeks without food. Most of us can survive 3 weeks.
But you have to be drinking water while you do it.
You have to. Yeah. So water is really, so that rule of threes kind of gives you an idea of, like, what's most important. 3 seconds without air, 3 minutes, I mean, 3 seconds without blood flow to the brain, 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without protection from extreme environment, you know, clothing, et cetera, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. So those are kind of your priorities, and that's for the rule of threes. And I just want to make one other thing note, is that the specific strategies for a dirty bomb, for a nuclear, surviving a nuclear detonation, or surviving a meltdown, they're very different strategies, and those are all in detail in my book, When Disaster Strikes. And so, you know, people want to know those strategies, please pick up that book, When Disaster Strikes, because the specific strategies are laid out right there, and they're very different for each of the scenarios.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Harry in Port Huron, Michigan. Go ahead, Harry.
Hey, thank you very much, George.
Sure thing.
Question for you, Matt. Where do you get the N95 masks at?
Okay, the N95 masks are any hardware store. That's
Army surplus too.
And you can get them at like Home Depot. You can similarly, like an Army surplus will have gas masks. Those will work even better. But I'm just saying, kind of a poor man's gas mask is those N95. They're what painters use. And they have carbon canisters on them, and 3M and other companies make them. And they're available at all, you know, Ace Hardware, Home Depot, Lowe's, all those kinds
of
places.
That expensive either.
They're not that expensive. They're like $20 or something like that, $25, something like that. And you can, I use them here, like I live in the High Sierras, and then we get really bad fire seasons out here on the West Coast, like there was horrendous fires in the Bay Area and in you know, Napa, Sonoma, where they burned out part of Santa Rosa this fall. And when you have those N95 masks, they'll filter out the smoke. not just the particles, but they also, the carbon sucks up the toxic gases and the things that really burn your lungs. So having an N95 mask will also filter out particles like from radiation. So radiation can be tiny particles, but usually they're stuck to bigger particles. And more than, you know, most of those, 99% of those particles are going to be filtered out by the N95 masks. And similarly, a gas mask is an even higher filtering capability, and you can get those at Army Surplus and online.
I should say, too, that our sponsor at the My Patriot Supply, they have a lot of these things you're talking about, man.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it. Okay, next up, Harry, thank you for your call. Donna in North Carolina, welcome to the program. Hi, Donna.
Hi, George. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I have two questions. Number one, worst case scenario, everything melts down. We're in a world of mess, and it cannot be fixed, right? Eventually, it's going to get cold. If you want to find somewhere, and you'll probably have to walk there to live where you won't be freezing to death all the time, would that be Mexico, Latin America, South America?
Well, you know, you have to be practical about where to go. The main thing is getting upwind and away from the downwind zone. And the other thing to think about is it's cumulative over time. So when the thing about the dirty bomb and the thing about the nuclear bomb going off is that gets cleaner and better over time. The thing about a power plant meltdown is the longer it's putting it out, the worse it is downwind. And so you have time to move, but the more you're exposed, it's cumulative. The longer you're exposed, the more chance you're going to breathe in or ingest some of those hot particles. So getting out of the downwind zone quickly is very important in the event of a meltdown. And thinking, you know, you can keep yourself warmer with clothing. It's more important to be in a place that has clean water and clean food, a place that grows more food than it consumes. Because after an event like that, if nothing's working, you need to be in an area that's a food, you know, that produces food and has clean water and clean air. And so that's your priority. And it may not be getting to Mexico because you may not be able to get there.
Or get in.
Yeah, or get in. So, you know, it all depends on where you are. I mean, sure, if you have close access to Mexico, there's no nuclear power plants down there that I know of, and it's a warmer climate, you know, it might be okay. It's a tough question, but thinking about how do you get there, how do you travel? Do you travel by mountain bike? Do you throw your mountain bike in your car? Do you put your hiking boots in and have a bunch of cloth adhesive tape? So that when you're hoofing it down the road, you know, after your gas runs out, if you're on a bicycle, you know, how do you protect yourself? Do you have a pistol or a handgun to protect yourself? You know, there's a lot of questions involved in that. And that's where careful planning ahead of time rather than reacting. Now, another thought is in a situation like this, if you have planned ahead and you have things like colloidal silver generator to make an antibiotic solution, and you save some medicines, there's going to be most likely a lot of culling out in a fairly short period of time due to disease. So if you can purify your water, if you have various backup, both regular medicines, traditional medicines, and alternative medicines, so you can keep you and your family healthy and alive, things might be, you know, culled out and thinned out quite a bit in, say, a month downstream. So there's a lot of different potentials. I hope it never happens. You know, preparedness is like you plan for the worst and hope for the best. And like car insurance, you know, you hope you never have to use it. You hope you never get in that head-on collision, and you hope that nuclear catastrophe never happens in your life.
We've got Ken truck driving in Illinois, first-time caller. Hello, Ken. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, George. First-time caller.
Well, good to have you with us. You too.
Hey, I have two questions. One is I was kind of wondering of an update on Fukushima and what their endeavors are there, what's going on, and why, you know, I mean, why isn't every country in the world getting, you know, trying to stop this? And the other question was, I understand there's another type of nuclear generator, I think it's thermal, Not too sure about that, but I was wondering why we're not switching over to something like that. It's supposed to be a lot safer.
Well, here's a little update on Fukushima. It's going to be decades before it's all cleaned up. But they've taken, when it happened, in 2011, so it's been six years now, coming up on 7 years in April, and they finally invented robots that can stand long enough to actually get inside and take some pictures. So they showed in the bottom of Fukushima just today, they released a picture of a big handle. Now, I was talking to Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.org, and he's the nuclear whistleblower I was talking about earlier. I was just speaking with him earlier today, and he said that picture of the handle that they took inside the containment vessel, or underneath the containment vessel, indicates, he said, that's almost a foot-long handle. So that means that the Fukushima didn't just crack the containment vessel, it blew holes in it or burned big holes in it, because debris, you know, like a foot size is falling through there. That can't just fall through a crack. So you're looking at a situation that is tenuous, and they built a big building around it to contain things, and they're working on developing the technologies to go in and decontaminate it. But it's going to be multiple decades before it's pulled apart. And if another huge earthquake happens in the meantime, there's a decent chance that you're going to see everything fall apart. You're going to see spent fuel ponds catch on fire. You're going to see problems. So it's what blows my mind is that other parts of the world are looking at Fukushima and looking at Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. And in spite of those problems and the billions and billions of dollars it's going to take to try and clean them up, and they'll never really be able to totally clean them up. They're just going to try and really contain them. And all of that money, and they're still building nuclear power plants, and they're still pretending that they can make these things safe. Now, when they sold nuclear power to the world, they sold it on the basis with calculations, theoretical calculations of safety factors. And given the 400 reactors in the world, and given those numbers they sold it to the world on, our first nuclear event that should have been much smaller than any of the five I'm talking about, three at Fukushima, one at Three Mile Island, and one at Chernobyl, those are five serious Level 7 events. The first Level 7 event, or Level 6 event, should have happened in 2,000 years, but we've had 5 in 50 years. So instead of one in 2,000 years, we're having them an average of one every 10 years. And there's no way, and yet, given that safety record, they're still planning to build more nuclear power plants in the world, and that just boggles my mind.
By big population centers, too.
Yeah, the average nuclear power plant, you know, more than one out of three Americans lives within 50 miles.
Oh, that's right. Matt, stay with us. We'll come back for some final calls. And a quick thing, the nuclear thermal rocket is a proposed spacecraft propulsion technology. I don't think they've used it yet for power, for energy, but they are using it for the rockets, and it could be amazing. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Matt Stein with us, our final segment with your calls as well. Matt, just amazing technology, if we can harness it, right?
You mean nuclear technology?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is that the numbers of it are so astounding that it really sucks the engineers in to say, wow, you know, this is an answer to our energy problems. But the problem is that it's so expensive and so difficult to safeguard, and we've never figured out the waste problem of what do we do with the waste when it's done. You know, you have something like the plutonium, 24,000-year half-life. What do you do with something that lasts for 24,000 years? Uranium-235, 704-million-year half-life. What do you do with that? That means half of it's still there in 704 million years from now. So it's very seductive because the energy numbers are so good. But the fact is that wind and solar alternative energies are so much cheaper and so much faster to implement that from the point of, you know, when you look at it from that point of view, it's like, why would you spend the money on nuclear? Well, one of the reasons is because if you don't have nuclear power plants, you don't have stuff to make bombs out of. And the military guys like to have the bomb stuff. You know, I mean,
yep.
they like to have it.
Next up, let's go to the phones. Bob in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Yes, hello, George.
Hey.
I want to thank you for the informative, beautiful, wonderful shows you do put on.
Thank you, sir. We have
and
a great
staff. I have a question or two for Matt. Also, one of them is on Chernobyl. I think we're coming up on 30 years, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so, yeah.
That they were going to roll that big cover over Chernobyl. And it was reported that I saw 6 inches thick of lead, this big cover. They were going to roll over it. And, of course, I guess they ran out of money.
Yeah, coming up on 32 years, by the way.
Yeah, and they stopped doing it. So, you know, you're saying that the pods, if you keep them cool, they won't go up in the atmosphere. But what was the idea of Chernobyl, that the 6-inch lead shield?
Well, they have the sarcophagus that they, you know, a couple hundred people died fairly short-term deaths from, basically gave their lives to Russia to encase it with concrete and steel and earth and stone. And, you know, in helicopters and all that stuff, they kept dumping stuff on it. And then they put a building around it, a concrete building. And then, you know, things were degrading over time. It's very radioactive. So I don't really know all of the details about the lead shield in the building. But
yeah.
The problem is you're looking at something that has to last for over 100,000 years, you know, to contain that. And how do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, that's a long period of time. And so right now they've got a building around Fukushima, and that kind of partially contains it. But, you know, who's going to be around in 100,000 years to make sure that nobody goes into these places that we poisoned? Who's going to make sure that what we build around them lasts over 100,000 years? I mean, this is insanity to keep pursuing this.
Yeah.
When you have stuff that lasts for hundreds, you know, 10, 20, 30,000, 100,000, millions of years for some of the, you know, for some of the.
Aren't we raising the radiation levels on Earth all the time with these accidents?
Well, we are, and we're also refining stuff that the Earth has encased these radioactive materials safely so that life could develop on Earth without it. And so then we're mining it and refining it and concentrating it. So nature takes these pollutants and disperses them and encases them and makes it safer and cleaner for life to exist. And humans go in and takes these pollutants and makes them more concentrated and more poisonous.
Now,
so
aren't
we're
we
doing
making
like the
ourselves
thicker,
though?
Does.
I mean, the radiation level's got to be increasing with these accidents.
It's increasing, but it's also the hot particles. Like, for instance, Arnie and Marco, a couple of nuclear scientists, took a whole bunch of samples from the United States and a bunch of samples from various places in Japan, air filters, clothing samples, soil samples, and they tested them. And what they found is that the samples varied radically in radioactive levels. But the higher samples were more than 10,000 times more radioactive than the lower samples. And so the materials from Chernobyl, they're really not finding, like, in the soil samples in the United States. Even though we talk about the radiation levels from Chernobyl getting here and stuff, and some detectable things in seawater, the samples they tested in the United States were free of any of the signatures of the products, byproducts that come out of Fukushima. But if you look at Japan, what they're doing is they're telling the people, because of money, that they've decontaminated a lot of these areas around Fukushima, and they're saying, we're going to cut away your funds that have been paying for, because you had to let go of your homes and move out, you've been, you know, living off the state, but now we're going to, if you don't move back to your homes, we're going to take away your funds. And plus, we're going to put the Olympics there, and we're going to have baseball over, you know, in Fukushima Prefecture to show the world how safe everything is.
Sure.
But the fact is that these soil samples and filter samples that Arnie and Marcos have tested are showing that there's tons, that there's hot particles. So they're gambling with these people's lives, because all it takes is sucking in one or two of those hot particles into their lungs or getting them in a kidney, and they're going to get tumors and they're going to die, you know, eventually of cancers from these hot particles. So it's Russian roulette. Some people will get the particles and some people won't. And they're telling the people that it's safe to move back. And they're telling the world that, look, nobody died from Fukushima. Nuclear power is safe, and that's just a lie, because people are dying. They're just dying from cancers and other issues, and they can't prove it was from Fukushima. Tell a little five-year-old kid in Tokyo who's got thyroid tumors that it had nothing to do with Fukushima. You know, I mean, come on. It's like, yes, it has it, but how are they going to prove it?
Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, thanks for calling.
Thank you, George, for another magnificent show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yes, I want to ask your guest a question, and then I have some comments.
Okay.
Who are the most psychopathic group of people on the planet? This is just a question to your guest.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't know that I could answer that, because there's a whole bunch of opportunities there. You could call them politicians. You could call them ISIS. You could call them whatever.
You said it right there, the politicians. Nothing happens without the politicians. These nuclear plants could not be built without the politicians. What the question I want to ask you is, I have a sneaking suspicion that those cores and those reactors that failed in Fukushima burn right through the ground and are now in the Pacific Ocean. You know, the media blackout, complete media blackout in the United States is just disgusting. So what is the real deal about what happened to those core reactors? Did they melt through the ground and into the Pacific Ocean itself, or does Arne Gundersen know?
Well, they have pictures, and Arne, you know, I've talked to Arne some about that. They have pictures that seem to indicate that they melted through the containment vessel that was supposed to hold all the nasty stuff inside in the event of an accident. They've definitely, gone through that. I don't think they've been China syndromed into the ground, but there's definitely leaking in. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going into the water. There are a lot of poisonous stuff. And in Vermont Yankee, that Arne was part of the commission looking at decommissioning the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, they've leaked a lot of highly radioactive stuff into the water table in places in Vermont around the plant. And if you look at the Columbia River from the feeder plant, that Vibridia reactor up in Washington is flowing into the Columbia River and poisoning that. So there's a lot of stuff where the scientists and engineers have persuaded the politicians that they know what they're doing and everything's safe, and trust me. But the data indicates that we can't prevent accidents from happening, and we can't prevent leaks from happening, and it does poison people, and people do die from this, and that's just the truth. So, you know, do people go follow the money? Or do they follow the data? Do they look at the people that are going to die from it? Or do they look at the money to be made from it? You know, there's a whole lot of things. And I wish I could fix the world and snap my fingers and make it better and shake people around and make them listen and make them wake up. But I haven't. I can do that to some people, but I can't do it to all, that's for sure.
Suzanne's with us in San Luis Obispo in California. Hi, Suzanne.
I am so glad you took my call. My call is for Matt.
Okay.
I live just south of Diablo Canyon. It's in San Luis Obispo. It's a nuclear plant.
Right. Very familiar with it.
Oh, well, there you go. She was built to handle 100 years of production, and they want to shut her down. I'm just south in a mobile home.
They weren't built to handle 100 years. Most of them are built for 40 years, and a lot of them have been extended to 50 and 60 years.
Not good.
So they were never built for 100 years.
You sound like you know what you're talking about, so I'll check my homework. But they want to close her down, and the argument with the San Luis Obispo board is she was built for 100. You want to shut her down before she's 50? It's all about money. I'm very concerned. Although it's not had an accident, it's just a matter of time.
What are the dangers of closing a nuke plant, Matt, and then taking it apart?
Well, they've never successfully really just taken it apart. It's so radioactive. They've basically become a toxic waste dump. The Diablo plant, they've shown that there's an active earthquake fault, like 50 or 100 yards offshore, very nearby. There was a fault they didn't realize originally. And so there's definitely, you know, really good reasons to close down Diablo Canyon. And the fact of the matter is that nuclear power costs about 8 times as much as solar and wind right now. So there's really no economic justification for keeping it going. And some people say that it's a low carbon alternative to help with climate change. But the fact of the matter is it takes so many years, like 20 years or so, to pay back the carbon that was used just to build the plant. So it's kind of like you can do solar and wind and have paybacks, you know, very, very quick instead of waiting 20 or 30 years to break even on the thing. So it's kind of a no-win situation, and you know, there's some big business behind it, a lot of money to be made in it, and like I said, the military guys like it because it provides material that they can turn into bombs and weapons. So I think the public's been sold a bad bill of goods on it, and, you know, shutting it down is much better than just keeping them running and building more.
Boy, if they can just clean it up right. Tom in the Bronx, welcome to the show. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, George. I'd like to say, your guest, I'd like to say this, that I mentioned before that enzymes, you know, I still believe where the Indian reservation is, where the oil went on the ground.
They eat it up.
The enzymes could, the ones they have in Canada, that they use on beaches there when they have spills, oil spills, and they clean up the Canadian beaches that way. I think that some sort of enzymes could be developed to handle the poison pools of nuclear waste that no one seems to know what to do with, and they just let it sit there and mildewing.
Well, unfortunately, there's no biological organisms that I have ever heard of that can transform, you know, radioactive elements. You know, those are
and eat that up like oil.
Yeah, they just can't be eaten up. I mean, you're talking about the basic building blocks of the universe. You're talking atoms, and you're talking specific atoms that are isotopes, that are radioactive isotopes of specific atoms and elements. And those are basic elements, and you don't just break down those elements into something else. You know, you don't transmute them. That's kind of like the Philosopher's Stone, where for thousands of years, you know, or 1,000 years, that people were trying to find a way to transform simple elements into gold, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg. There are some things in nature that appear to do some kind of minor transmutation of elements, but that's a physics way beyond me, and it's not something that I think has ever been done on a significant scale. And so I think our post, you know, putting the hopes of humanity in the future of the Earth, pinning that on the ability to do some kind of philosopher's stone of finding a way to transmute these radioactive isotopes into non-radioactive elements that are totally different, I think that's a lot of pie in the sky and a lot of science fiction and a lot of pinning hopes on something that has a minuscule chance of ever panning out.
Matt, take the next 30 seconds we have left and just give us your websites, please.
Okay. My website is whentechfails.com, whentechfails. And if you go to that site, there's a article under survival on building the ultimate survival kit. And there's links there to purchase a number of things that I really recommend you have. I don't make any money off of this. I don't sell anything directly other than signed books if you want to buy them on my websites. But there's great free articles on survival, purifying water, survival kits, medical kits, all that stuff. Highly recommend you go there. And if you can, pick up my books, When Disaster Strikes or When Technology Fails.
Super.
They're available anywhere.
Matt, keep in touch with us, my friend. We will be back in a moment to talk to a medical anthropologist. I'll tell you what that is when we come back.